Right now it's time for Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm really delighted to be bringing you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll discuss various aspects of elephants with Joyce Poole. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune. This is Earl Van Dyke and the Soul Brothers with Too Many Fish in the Sea here on Talking Animals. This is Earl Van Dyke and the Soul Brothers with Too Many Fish in the Sea, an animal tune of sorts as we ease into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be hearing from today's guest, Joyce Poole, who holds a PhD in elephant behavior from Cambridge University. Is co-founder of Elephant Voices and is considered one of the world's foremost elephant experts. We'll find out about some of Dr. Poole's more significant findings about elephant behavior and communication and more when we hear from Joyce Poole in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later, we'll be giving away a pair of tickets to Johnny Lang's concert May 21st at Ruth Eckert Hall in Name That Animal Tune. Right now, though, it's time for animal news items and or announcements, starting with of course, very important things related to the awful oil spill. And the Suncoast Seabird Sanctuary and Avian Hospital needs donations. And its trained staff is on standby to assist with the Gulf oil spill crisis with over 300 volunteers on call if needed. The sanctuary is it is asking for more volunteers to be on emergency call. And donations to the Avian Hospital at 18328 Gulf Boulevard, Indian Shores, right here in Florida, of course. Volunteers would need to receive hazardous materials training. The sanctuary is the largest wild bird hospital in the U.S., based on the admission of over 800 injured birds each year. It is set up to immediately triage and stabilize fluids to oiled, malnourished, or injured birds. They need all kinds of donations for this obviously huge mission that's about to unfold, including linens, kennels, towels, sheets, Dawn detergent, paper towels, bottled water, and Gatorade. If possible, bring those items to the sanctuary again at 18328 Gulf Boulevard and Indian Shores. For a complete list and more information, please see seabirdsanctuary.com or call over there 727-391-6211 for more information. And to volunteer, you can also email over there to jessicag@seabirdsanctuary.com. jessicag@seabirdsanctuary.com. You need all the help they can get, and I think the more organized and equipped they are with donations, obviously, the better this whole awful thing is going to go. So let's keep our fingers crossed and do everything we can. Also coming up, this coming Saturday, something you could do before you go to the WNF Tropical Heatwave Extravaganza. This is underway from at 9 a.m., and it's going to take place between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. at Centennial Park, Ybor City. It's called Good Dog Day, and it's a family and pet-friendly fun celebrating dogs and owners, taking place during National Dog Bite Prevention Week. And among the things going on over there will be free doggy nail trims, free dog training tips, plus contests and prizes for good dogs. Good dogs, of course, being the operative phrase. Pet adoptions, ask the vets, food shopping, and giveaways. There's bite prevention education, even a special bringing home baby safety tips element. So for more information, you can call over to Hillsborough County Animal Services at 813-744-5660. That's 813-744-5660. Or you can visit hillsboroughcounty.org/animalservices for more information. So, let's step now into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Mike Kaplan with a piece called Ducks and Vegetarianism on today's Comedy Corner here on Talking Animals.
I was in a Chinese restaurant recently, and I was thinking about how a small duck is called a duckling. And I canceled my order of dumplings. Because I am a vegetarian, so... Do we have any other vegetarians here? That is a little better than I got at the steakhouse. Great. Great. I did comedy in a steakhouse. Honestly, I was like, hey, are there any vegetarians here? Finally, one guy in the back was like, this is a steakhouse! So I moved on. I was like, okay, any Jews here? This is a steakhouse! We eat Jews here! So I left. Like, people hear that, they assume I'm always into other kinds of activism. They're like, oh, you're a vegetarian. Do you care about the environment? No. I eat the environment. That's what we do. It's made of vegetables. But I do eat some weird things, like pickle sandwiches, like a nice dill pickle on sourdough bread, or a sour pickle on dildo bread. And that's just a word one, everybody. Good work. Good work. I think words are important. They're really all that separate us from the mimes, you know? So... Here's another word, pescatarian. You know that one? That means my mom, she says she's a vegetarian, but she's really a pescatarian, which means she eats fish in addition to lying about being a vegetarian. That's what she does. She actually says she's like, I'll become a vegetarian when fish becomes a vegetable, which is sadly not the way evolution is heading, so... Unless people are getting dumber and animals are reverting back into plants, which would be all right, but...
All right, that was Mike Kaplan. With a piece called Ducks and Vegetarianism, taken from his album Vegan Mind Meld. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs, including our most recent shows with Kat DiPoHancho, Shelley Thayer, snake conservationist Matt Ellerbeck, and veteran vegetarian rocker Joan Jett. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page. Become our fan, will ya? And our Twitter page, please follow us. Plus, there's a place to subscribe to our email newsletter so we can keep you posted on forthcoming guests, program news, and more. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to hear from today's guest, Joyce Poole, so let me outline a few things about her. As I mentioned earlier, she holds a PhD in elephant behavior from Cambridge University, is co-founder of Elephant Voices, and is considered one of the world's foremost elephant experts. Dr. Poole has studied elephants for more than 30 years, yielding the discovery of musk and male African elephants and other significant findings about elephant behavior and communication. So, speaking from her home in Norway in a conversation recorded last week, this is Joyce Poole on Talking Animals. By the way, she preferred that I call her Joyce versus Doctor, so that's what I did.
So let's welcome to Talking Animals, Joyce Poole. Thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, Joyce.
You're welcome, Duncan. It's nice to talk to you.
Thank you. So over the many, many years that you've devoted to studying elephants, you've been responsible for some enormously important discoveries or findings, some which obviously I hope to explore with you in a moment here. But first I'd like to start by asking you, what's a fact about elephants that just a layperson might find, you know, quite surprising?
Well, I guess one of the very surprising things is that they're capable of imitating other sounds. And I recorded an elephant imitating the sound of a truck.
Wow. So it wasn't just imitating other animals or other even sounds in nature, but obviously, you know, a truck sound or something that is mechanical. Were there other instances of that where it was, again, not other elephants or even other animals, but other, you know, non-nature sounds that you've...
Well, there are elephants have been reported to imitate the sounds of lawnmowers. There's an elephant in a Korean zoo that apparently imitates the sounds his keeper giving him orders.
Wow.
And then we have an African elephant imitating the sounds of Asian elephants that are different. So it's kind of early stages in this research, but
yeah.
it was pretty funky to have an elephant imitating the sound of a truck.
Well, right, and so I know it's early in the research, but so far, is it your thought that this is like something kind of playful, or is there something more at work here that prompts them to do this?
Well, I think in the case of these elephants, who were mostly captive or semi-captive elephants,
yeah,
they may have been doing it out of boredom.
Mm-hmm.
But the capacity they have for imitation obviously exists in the wild, too. And so we speculate that it may be about, maintaining bonds in this very closely knit family groups that they have.
Ah, well, sort of pursuing this path here, let's talk a little elephant talk. I mean, in broad strokes, perhaps you could explain the way you pursued your understanding of otherwise how elephant vocalizations work, not counting the impressions, of course, and sort of what they mean.
Well, there's lots of different calls made by elephants, and you know, I was seeing male elephants and their sexual behavior, sexual and aggressive behavior, before I got into looking at their vocal communication. And male elephants make this very, very low frequency sound. In fact, it was so low that I didn't realize it was a vocalization at first. And that we discovered that sound, and we discovered that elephants make sound below the level of human hearing back in the mid-80s,
mm-hmm.
Together with Katie Payne. And I got so excited about that I went on to, you know, study their other sounds. But having watched elephants for so many years and watched how they interact and knowing who was, you know, mother and who's daughter and who are sisters and so on, that makes it a bit easier to figure out what these different sounds mean. For instance, if a calf is walking alongside its mother with its trunk up in a sort of snorkel position,
mm-hmm.
And making a little sound, and the mother then stops and puts a leg forward, and the calf begins to suckle, then if you see that over and over again, and you hear the same sounds over and over again, then you start to put two and two together. Oh, this sound means, Mom, stop.
Mm-hmm.
I need something to drink.
Yeah. Wow. So
it must,
So it must have been quite exciting to start to piece together, in a sense, really, really cracking their code in the example you gave, but probably several others where you really started to see, well, this means, hey, stop here. This
right.
means let's stop.
Yeah.
Let's swim here. Let's move in this direction. Hey, careful.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely. I mean, one of my favorites is what we call the let's go rumble. You know, these low-frequency calls that elephants make are called rumbles.
Yeah.
And they have one that apparently means let's go, or I want to go this way, let's go together. And an adult female, will stand on the edge of her group and face the direction she wants to go and then start making a lot of intention movements, you know, lifting a leg, swinging it. And then give this call repeatedly. It's kind of a long, drawn-out, relatively flat rumble. And, eventually, sometimes, if she's successful, she'll get the rest of her family to sort of turn in her direction, and then they'll move off.
Wow. Well, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Joyce Poole, who holds a Ph.D. in elephant behavior from Cambridge University and is the co-founder of an organization called Elephant Voices. This conversation was recorded last week. So I guess that makes me wonder, Joyce, I mean, because obviously to crack that code, you have to, of course, not only hear the sounds or at least gather what the sounds mean by observing their behavior very closely. So when in the times that you were, you know, all those years out in the field, to research these vocalizations, did you find that the elephants kind of inherently understood that you were, if not a kindred spirit, then at least something they didn't have to be concerned about or threatened about, you know, in terms of your presence there, or did that change over time as they just maybe became more accustomed to your presence and maybe you became more confident about being amongst them?
A little bit of both. I mean, the population that I've mostly worked in is the Amboseli elephants, and they are just because they've been watched by people, other researchers, and tourists over decades.
Mm-hmm.
At least the elephants inside the park are very relaxed about cars approaching them. But we have had immigrant elephants who are very, you know, nervous, and elephants come down from Kilimanjaro and so on, and they can get pretty alarmed when you approach them. But we learn how to approach elephants. You never approach an elephant from behind. You always sort of circle around and come toward them from the front, and if they raise their ears in alarm, you turn off the engine and so on and so forth. So gradually over time, they learn that you're not a threat.
Sure.
And then you can, I mean, now we can approach them to within, you know, a meter or two.
Well, and also I in sort of reviewing the website, the elephantvoices.org website, which I want to come back to in just one sec. But for example, I saw in there somewhere that describes the way that in the way you're just sort of discussing now, but that you learned, you know, when out of a vehicle to move in kind of a, like they described it as a bent over posture and sort of extremely slow movement, sometimes freezing if, you know, you felt like they were a bit wary. And
that's right. Well, elephants, you know, they get killed by people on foot.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're very wary of the human shape.
Sure.
So I find if I bend over and I look a little bit different and freeze, as you said, every time they look up alert, they don't seem to see you if you're holding completely still.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Wow. Well, let me also just elaborate too that I saw this thing I've just noted on the elephantvoices.org website, which I find is a fantastic website. It's enormously deep and rich, and you know, in recent periods I've developed what I consider to be a healthy addiction to it, and as I say to my wife and others, forget Facebook. My online time is spent at elephantvoices.org. I mean, those are my friends that I want to have. So, how did you approach creating it? Obviously, it's you know, full of databases, and just of course represents, I guess, just a lot of the research and other findings that you've accumulated over many, many years.
Yeah, I mean, Elephant Voices was really my husband's idea. He's, you know, he worked in communication and in large companies and done all sorts of things, and fell in love with me and then with elephants. And so we sort of combined forces and got the idea to get this website up and out there with the idea of sharing the voices of elephants with the public, and at the same time be able to act as a voice. Elephant.
Yeah, maybe you could even elaborate on you know, Elephant Voices itself, its history and its, you know, you've touched on its mission, but maybe more broadly its mission and maybe your role specifically there.
Yeah, the mission of Elephant Voices is to inspire wonder in the intelligence, complexity, and voices of elephants, and to secure a kinder future for them through research and the sharing of knowledge. So the educational side of what we do is very important.
And to me, as a longtime elephant nut, I guess even, I mean, they do inspire wonder. And some of that's been sort of a long, you know, standing fascination of mine, but certainly greatly deepened when I was fortunate enough to take a trip to Africa several years ago, and in fact ended up at Amboseli. So I guess I'm curious how you would say, like, I have a six-year-old boy, and he sees all the elephant pictures and paintings and artwork all over my office and really throughout our house, and you know, is curious about them, and we talk about why I feel the way I do about elephants. But in terms of inspiring wonder in this little boy, and again, we're not going to, you know, certainly not going to go to a circus and probably not going to go to a zoo, what would you recommend to beyond what I can tell him and maybe show him, you know, as a way, you know, for not just Mike, but you know, all the Mikes out there to inspire wonder in him as well.
Mm. Well, I mean, gosh, my own daughter, of course, was very lucky because she grew up in Africa and out watching elephants while I was studying them. She was on the rooftop.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, she just loved the Echo of the Elephant film, the BBC productions, and would watch them over and over and over again. And I certainly feel that a child can learn more about elephants from watching some of these great documentaries than they can by going to the zoo. That said, there's nothing like being up close and personal with such a you know, a large animal. And what I'm hoping is that some of the zoos will drop their elephants, but install instead a sort of multimedia theater where they can have IMAX productions and perhaps you know, a link in to a field site in Africa where kids can actually ask questions to researchers out in the field or follow, you know, an individual elephant's life.
Well, okay, let me remind folks again, this is Talking Animals, and in a conversation recorded last week, I'm speaking with Joyce Poole, who holds a PhD in elephant behavior from Cambridge University and is the co-founder of an organization called Elephant Voices. Because I think that would be great, of course, if zoos were to do that. I hope it's not too cynical for me to think that it seems like for a lot of zoos that still do have elephants, and of course, in many cases, some zoos and zoo directors have decided that's just not something they're comfortable doing, is exhibiting elephants. But for many, I guess it seems like it's clearly for them an important drawing card, and in fact, some seem to cling, you know, furiously to even a single elephant, and maybe you like, I mean, there's a sort of a very current issue that deals exactly with that, and I don't know if you'd like to speak to that. This what I'm referring to is this elephant, Queenie, that lives in the San Antonio Zoo, and the zoo executive director recently had some rather dismissive comments about elephant sanctuaries when there's a movement afoot to try to maybe get this elephant moved there and be amongst other elephants and have some space. And frankly, I had some dismissive comments about your own expert opinion in this matter. So just in the interest of equal time or something resembling it, I guess I should offer you an opportunity to respond to any or all of that.
Yeah. So I find this conversation so tiring. Mm-hmm. I guess, I mean, I'm in a very privileged position because I have spent so many years watching elephants.
Yeah.
And one of the things that really... I suppose, you know, when you're watching every move they make out there, you realize that their trunks are always on the go. They're always sniffing the ground, sniffing the air. They're stopping to listen. And because they've got this very low-frequency hearing and they can pick up and they themselves can make very powerful sounds that carry several kilometers, these guys are able to have basically conversations with other animals, say, a kilometer, 2 kilometers away. They recognize the individual voices of up to 200 other elephants. They're able to pick up scents from a couple of kilometers away. They're able to pick up vibrations of other elephants vocalizing through the ground, through their feet. So these are animals that are constantly thinking about what other members of their society are doing, and they
mm-hmm.
live in a very large social network. So to take these animals and stick them in a very tiny half an acre, an acre, 4 acre enclosure means that you're creating a life of terrible boredom for animals that are highly intelligent and highly social.
Yeah.
But that is something that someone like Mr. McCusker can't possibly understand, because although he says we know elephants better than, say, Joyce Poole, he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't, because he hasn't spent the time watching those kind of minute details. So keeping an elephant on a half acre, never mind the physical problems that elephants suffer by not moving around,
yeah.
they just don't have, it doesn't allow them the kind of complexity that they need to keep them psychologically healthy.
Sure. Well, and along those lines, I guess, so with this sort of discussion, I'd feel remiss if we didn't touch on circuses, which, of course, I think have the problems you've described, and then, you know, in some ways, some additional more severe problems. I mean, what sort of prospects do you think there are for ending the use of elephants and other animals, frankly, in American circuses? I mean, is that back to what I was noting about zoos, or at least zoos that have elephants? I mean, that's a crucial drawing card, obviously, for the ringling folks and others. I mean, to them, it's hard to imagine probably, you know, how they could do the kind of business they do without those, with the parade of circus elephants. Yeah.
I had an email came in today with an article that suggested that the elephants were worth to Ringling Brothers something like $100 million
yeah.
a year.
Yeah.
I still think that in the end, it's people who are going to decide. And if people really understand what these animals have to go through to act in the circus, then eventually they're going to say, no, this is not what we want. This is just not right in this day and age in our great country. And I believe that in my lifetime, there will be a change. And I don't think we'll have elephants in circuses. And I don't even think we'll have many elephants in zoos, except zoos that are of the order of sanctuary-sized spaces for elephants.
Yeah. Well, that's, boy, that gives me great hope. And I'm wondering how you think that will come about, because it seems like, you know, people speak out as you've done, and people do radio shows about this as I've done, and there's, you know, uh-huh. people, you know, hold protests whenever Ringling and other such circus come to town, and I think they do educate people about what happens, and I think as people learn what kind of treatment those elephants and other animals experience, many turn on their heels and walk away. But, I mean, that also, to me at least, represents a drop in the proverbial bucket. So how do we affect the much larger scale change that you're, you know, sort of predicting?
But think how far we've come. I mean, for me, it seems like, it's been, you know, such a job, and we're not moving fast enough. But yet, you know, when I started studying elephants back in 1975, I was one of the first people studying their behavior.
Yeah.
So everything we know about elephant behavior has really been discovered since Ian Douglas Hamilton started, let's say, in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really pretty recent, all these amazing discoveries, and more are being made every day. And, you know, elephants and, you know, they're not just these big, dumb animals anymore. People see them as this living in matriarchal families and this incredible communication. And so I think we've come really a long way, and that's what's leading to this, you know, the voices that are saying, no, we should not be keeping them the way we are. And, yes, there's a lot of stubbornness there.
Yeah.
But I think the pressure is mounting, and I think you're going to see more and more change coming. I mean, already in Norway, they've, you know, the recommendation now is to drop elephants in circuses. It looks like it's going that way in the UK as well. So I think we're going to see change.
That's
but
great.
People have to stand up and be heard.
Right. Well, no, I think that's great. That's the kind of optimism that really sort of gladdens my heart, because and I should point out that I'm speaking to you in Norway, which is why of course you made that reference. But you know, we're in the sort of final moments of a recorded conversation with Joyce Poole, an internationally recognized expert on elephants. So maybe if I could, just in our last minute or so here, Joyce, actually maybe let me end where perhaps I would have otherwise begun, which is what first, as you said, you've been studying them, you know, almost as long as anybody. What first drew you to them? What first drew you to studying elephants back those many years ago?
Well, you know, I was really lucky because I grew up in Africa, too. So I moved to Africa when I was, I guess, 6 or 7 years old, and met my first wild elephant when I was 7 and got charged and terrified. But I guess it was that kind of rush of adrenaline. And also, I have to say, I went to a lecture by Jane Goodall when I was 11 in Nairobi, and I turned to my mother then and said, "That's what I'm going to do when I grow up."
Wow!
So I was inspired by her.
Yeah.
And I hope I've inspired a lot of people as well. And
wow.
we need more people out there.
Right. Well, and it's so great that there's sort of that ripple effect, because you know, the way Jane Goodall inspired you've obviously inspired a number of people, and as you say, now there's all kinds of great advances in really learning more about elephants and how we should be treating them and what we should and shouldn't be doing. So I think on that note, that's sort of the perfect place to leave it. Again, this has been Joyce Poole. The website, fantastic, fantastic website, is elephantvoices.org. And again, thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals and all your great work on behalf of elephants and other animals over many, many years.
Thanks so much, Duncan. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks a lot.
I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. There'll be a prize, a pair of tickets to Johnny Lang's concert May 21st at Ruth Eckert Hall. To the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune, an admittedly hackneyed musical reference to the conversation we just aired, it's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. All right, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. The program airs twice a month, specifically the first and second Wednesday of each month, so we'll return Wednesday, June 2nd. I hope you'll join me then. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby McKenna. My thanks to her. Incidentally, there are some wonderful photographs and video clips of the Talking Animals Festival at the festival page of talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals, be kind to others, be kind to yourself. We're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune. This is brand new music from Minus the Bear, who will be performing locally at the Ritz tonight and on the Sonic Detour this afternoon with Animal Backwards on WMNF. See you Saturday at Tropical Heat Wave.
She's a wolf looking through my window.